The New Testament, the first letter of Paul to the Corinthians, chapter 11, verses 17 to 22. So we now come to a consideration of the Lord's Supper. And because, as we said, our recorded communion service takes place next Sunday morning, I think it appropriate to reserve the bulk of this passage for that morning, taking Daniel chapter 9 in the evening, so that we will take the preliminary verses to the communion passage. Chapter 11, verses 17 to 22 now. Paul has discussed a wide variety of matters in these chapters in 1 Corinthians, some of them raised by the Corinthians themselves in the context of sectional strife, an extreme case of immorality, lawsuits between believers, the matter of marriage, the rights of an apostle, with warnings from Israel's backsliding experiences in the Old Testament about temptation, and the burning question of eating flesh offered in heathen temples and then offered for sale in the butcher market and partaken of in the homes of the people. Last Sunday evening, the relation of the sexes in the life of the church was considered, along with what was seemly for women to wear as signifying their difference from men. There was, I think, fairly general agreement from any reaction reaching me on what was said, that a woman's hair is basically her covering, but that does not preclude a woman wearing, as of old, in addition, a head covering or veil as a sign of woman's place in the fellowship. This leads on at verse 17 to another more serious matter with regard to worship in the Corinthian church, namely unseemly behavior at the Lord's table. This all arose, of course, because the Corinthians made the occasion of the Lord's Supper an actual meal, whereas we are accustomed, along with the church in general for centuries now, to the breaking of bread being a token partaking only, usually in rather solemn circumstances, since we feel we are never nearer the cross of the Lord Jesus in thought than when we are partaking of the symbols of his broken body and shed blood. There was for a time in the early church meals accompanying the breaking of bread called love feasts or agape feasts. Agape, A-G-A-P-E, in the English being the Greek word, or one of the Greek words for love. These at first seemed to have preceded the actual breaking of bread. Later, we understand from some of the scholars, Robertson and Plummer in particular, the breaking of bread preceded the actual meal and was transferred from evening to morning. Whether that means they were separated from one another is not said, but it is historically true that eventually the meal ceased in the life of the church. When we first had evening communions here, the question was raised by someone of somewhat Anglican background, why the Lord's Supper in the evening? But it was pointed out that, contrary to Roman Catholic and Anglican tradition, it is a supper, not a breakfast. Beyond the reference here to irregularities at the Lord's table, there are in the New Testament two other such references. You will find them at 2 Peter 2:13 and something the same in Jude, second last book in the New Testament, Jude verse 12. And these two references tell the same tale of unseemly goings on at the Lord's table at communion. Presumably, the references there are to other places, or another place. Which, of course, is more than surprising to us. I mean, the disturbance and the irregularity. Because in most traditions, most Christian traditions, the communion service is often so overburdened with formal solemnity and very often ritualistic palaver that many have reacted against that to make the Lord's Supper the simplest service possible. And this has certainly been our aim here. But even so, the reverent hush which usually accompanies the partaking of the elements in most churches is such that the idea of a fellowship meeting with a high degree of sociability and much eating and drinking, carousing and even drunkenness suggests something more like a wedding feast than a sacrament commemorating our blessed Lord's death, and is so different from our experience that it is hard for us to imagine what it was like. Indeed, even in the most liberated charismatic assemblies, we imagine the people are perhaps more subdued at the breaking of bread than at any other time. So that, as I say, it is difficult for us to imagine such unruly behavior associated with the Lord's table and the Lord's cross. Nonetheless, the very gathering together for spiritual fellowship naturally may lead to social fellowship, as it does with us after the services here on Sunday. And this has been a danger, we suppose, from the beginning of the church's history. In fact, Gilcomston's history, this congregation's history, is an interesting case in point. Our congregation emerged from the disruption in 1843, when a majority of the people who worshipped in the original Gilcomston at the other end of Summers Street, in a building much older than ours, in which, as a matter of fact, I have learned my great-grandfather, Alexander Still, was baptized in 1805 by the famous Dr. Kidd, whose portrait hangs in the vestry. I say, the majority of the people of Gilcomston then, in 1843, who worshipped there, broke away to form Gilcomston Free Church. And you may still see GFC carved on our communion chairs. The designation free referred to the fact that those who broke away rebelled against the patronage of the church by landed proprietors and endorsed by the civil magistrate who chose ministers and foisted them on the people so that the church was dominated by the state, which paid the salaries of the ministers of the Church of Scotland. Such patronage had been rejected at the Reformation and in the Revolution settlement in 1690. But alas, the patronage was reintroduced in 1712, making the minister dependent on the aristocracy. Of course, behind the political revolution lay a spiritual one. For the intrusion of the state into the governance of the Christian church led to a complacent spirit of what was called moderatism, which was the spiritual ruin of the church and which clouded the true nature of the gospel, the church becoming virtually an arm of the state. So that although sincere believers remained within the state church, the parish church, at the disruption, 1843, it was the breath of genuine revival, as Geoffrey Grogan, formerly of the Bible Training Institute in Glasgow, puts it. It was the breath of genuine revival which swept through the church that led Thomas Chalmers, a moderate himself until his conversion, to be inflamed with the fire of the gospel, which, burning in his heart, drove him to consider the implications of what was virtually to him a newfound faith. And as some of you know, it sent the Gilcomston free men out from the state church at the other end of Somers Street to find a new place to worship, which included at one point worshiping in our music hall down in Union Street and then in Huntley Street until this site on Union Street was found. All this, of course, is found in the first volume of the Gilcomston story. But on maturer consideration, one wonders whether it has ever been the best thing to do, even if it has often seemed necessary, to break away to form new denominations. Because it is a fact of history that they in turn can and often do become as diverted from their primary aim and purpose as the ones they left. I am sure that ideally speaking, it would have been far, and notice what I say, ideally speaking, I don't want to be misinterpreted and misreported. Ideally speaking, it would have been far better if Martin Luther had been able to contain his newfound faith within the bosom of the Catholic Church, corrupt as it was. I would certainly say the same for the breakaway of the Methodists from the Church of England. I'm not saying it would have been possible, nor am I going into the facts of these cases now. But inasmuch as the tendency of even the purest group of believers, being still sinners and open to Satan's temptations, to depart sooner or later from their purity, since extremes always lead to distortion, it were better if all heresy could be combated within the original establishment and not outside it, which is what we evangelicals in the Church of Scotland, almost alone in Presbyterian churches throughout the world, are seeking to do. Please note that, almost alone. Most of our evangelical friends in Presbyterian churches in America, Canada, Australia, other places, have broken away from the Presbyterian Church and have formed new Presbyterian churches to stand for the truth. God has thus far kept us, and a growing number of us, as I shall see tomorrow at Crieff, within a very mixed and often corrupt Church of Scotland. But when we consider the first breakaway, which was that of the Apostle Paul from the synagogue, and here I am actually counseling perfection, for it would have been impossible for Paul to continue in the synagogue, because it became to him virtually a synagogue of Satan, in which he could no longer operate at all. Luther would doubtless have said the same, and maybe even Wesley, and certainly William Booth of the Salvation Army. It was the ragged urchins which Booth brought into the Methodist Church, which his respectable members objected to, and that was how the Salvation Army started. But why am I saying all this in this context? Because it is the inevitable tendency of human nature, and this section of what I'm saying now I will be repeating to the ministers at Crieff tomorrow, because it is the inevitable tendency of human nature, because of its social gregariousness, to expand and develop associations until they become very different from their original, so that aims become clouded as new practices become traditions, and eventually the original aim becomes neglected and practically forgotten. The Free Church of Scotland, after the disruption in 1843, began very well. But within 20 years, even earlier, worldly elements began to appear in the Free Church of Scotland, probably fostered by complacency at her costly decision to secede and depart from the Church of Scotland, along with subversive theological elements from the continent, continental scholars, which, creeping in, sought to outdo the state church. For example, in the character of the buildings they erected for worship, along with even more adequate church halls, which by their very existence encourage social activities. Were they ever necessary? Take a look at the foursquareness of that great hulk of a church at the other end of Summer Street. And then take a look at what this building became with all its intricate architectural features, which we'll soon be seeing again, with its multicolored stonework. look at the front of the church hall and see the multi-colored stonework there. Or go to the Episcopal Church, St. Mary's and Garden Place, which is so elaborate in its multicolored stone that we call it the Tartan Kirkie. That was typical of many free churches, which then at the turn of the century, 1900, became United Free Churches, as this did from 1900 to 1929. And you can see the elaborateness of the architecture in, for example, Ferry Hill South Church, Holborn West Church, Carden Place Church, now turned into offices or something of the kind, Queen's Cross Church. An elaboration that the Church of Scotland never indulged in. There was a lot of pride there. You see, where the Church is not resolute in maintaining her first intent, which is to devote herself, is it not, to prayer and the ministry of the word. That's what the church is for. You knew that, didn't you? That the church is for prayer and the ministry of the word. Almost full stop. She will soon become another outfit, and has so often become another outfit altogether. You see, this began classically in Acts chapter 6 with the needs of the widows who had to be catered for, and doubtless many other needs and wants had to be attended to, until in the usual rather vulgar phrase, the tail ultimately began to wag the dog. And a tail is hardly a good enough instrument of sensible canine action. Much less is a social round capable of sustaining a Christian church if it is to maintain its original function. I needn't rub it in, but the socialization of this congregation began last century, and by the first 20 years of this century, Gilcomston was well on the way to becoming a social fellowship whose center of gravity was less and less the church on the Lord's Day, or even weekday meetings such as Band of Hope or Bible classes, but youth organizations and other organizations set to raise the money, notice, to raise the money which people were not putting into the plate on Sunday because they weren't there. They came to all sorts of social occasions, such as pie suppers, parties, concerts, and the like, ostensibly to raise money to support the church, but also, of course, to advance the social life of their fellowship and community. The absolute nadir of that was reached, so I am told, when one Sunday evening at an evening dress concert in the church hall, the then minister, dear man, who was more a psychologist than a pastor, raised his hand to pronounce a benediction at the end of the concert with a cigarette between his fingers. This was a dying church which Presbytery had tried to close twice, but which apparently would do anything but what was right in God's eyes. Even they're seeking me to be their minister was for the wrong reason. I came to Gilcomston when it was at its lowest ebb, and the reason why they sought me so earnestly after dismissing 27 former applicants was that during the war and during my university career, I had filled the largest churches in the city for sacred concerts on Sunday afternoons. There was so little of interest during the war, and because of the blackout, there couldn't be evening services. They said the man who could do that would fill their kirk, and so they invited me to come. But to what end? To fill a church for a sacred concert. You see, the fellow who gained popularity as a musical divinity student in the early 1940s turned out to be a very different man from the one who was arrested from his dithering Glasgow assistantship by an argument with a train, an argument which could have cost him his life, but really relegated him to a hospital bed for 3 months to think. And so he came hirpling to Gilcomston on two sticks in 1945. Precisely on the day the war ended in the West, his own 34th birthday. And he turned out to be a flaming evangelist who embarrassed his people with the fierceness of his gospel tactics. And you see, this is the background to the kind of thing which in another day led to the unseemly situation in the Corinthian church, which apparently, being a fellowship with a good mixture, including both the well-off and the poor, became a source of faction on issues of personalities. And also, among other things, in its practices at the meals associated with the Lord's Supper. Mind you, although I came to be a flaming evangelist, I still wanted to be popular, but evangelistically so. And yet the fact of being humbled by the accident when the Lord nearly took my life told me that I had to be faithful to the Lord above all things. And it took only a few years to prove, less than two, that you can't have it both ways. For absolute faithfulness to the Lord and His Word soon makes solid inroads into popularity, and in the end demolishes it entirely. So you see, the one thing that faithfulness to the Lord required was that the church should be the church, prayer and the Word, and never become a mere social institution. All eating and drinking, therefore, apart from the Lord's Supper, was out. And that obtained for many years here, until the very idea of a mere social fellowship was thoroughly hit on the head and breathed its last. Can you imagine then how impatient we are of people who appear amongst us with other ideas from other places and want to turn the clock back to what ruined the church? Not only this congregation, but of all those buildings that are now closed and turned over to secular uses. Indeed, I could be almost brutal with such people who make other suggestions, because they simply don't know what they're talking about and should not be listened to for a moment. Tomorrow morning, I will face something like 200 ministers, and that will be less than two-thirds of our mailing list. And it is the burden and passion of my heart that they see their calling, what it is and what it isn't. Some may not see it, and I have therefore little or no hope for such. But I hope that at least a minority, I hope a growing minority, will begin to see what we are seeking to say and to do in the Church of Scotland, and who will follow in the train as we seek to follow Christ. I invite, therefore, all of you, not least those who may be here in church for the very first time, to join me in this glorious endeavor of seeking to retain Christ's church for Christ, the church to remain the church, prayer and the word. Intent on prayer and the ministry of the word, with all other adjunct and auxiliary activities left floating. Do you understand what I mean? Left floating and never, never incorporated into the essential structure of the congregation. If I can get scores, better still, hundreds of dear minister friends all over Scotland and far beyond other lands to see this and to be determined to pursue it as their aim, then the church in Scotland would do what Billy Graham said in the General Assembly it should do. Have an influence on world Christianity. That's what he said. Such as no other church could have. It is possible. I want you to pray that the ministry of our church will see this, and that the congregations will respond and prove that this is the way to perpetuate a real church, not a mere religious organization from generation to generation, our children growing up within it. The tragedy, you see, of the Church of Scotland today is that in nominal fellowships, nominal Church of Scotland fellowships all over the town and all over the country, there are very few members, very few elders, and not all ministers who can get the children to attend church. during adolescent years, and they're lost. Lost to the church. There must be hundreds and thousands of young men in Aberdeen whose parents are members or whose fathers are elders in the Church of Scotland who never darken the door of a church. Whose fault is that? Is it theirs? No! It's their fathers and their mothers and their elders and their ministers. This is the only hope of turning this wild generation of young people who mill about this street and disturb us so much from this filthy den up the road, to turn them into godly boys and girls and men and women who love the Lord and who will commit themselves to Him and become the ministers and the elders and the missionaries of Christ's church, to scatter throughout the earth, as the Korean church is doing to our shame today. God grant us grace to follow in this train and see these wonderful things happen in days to come. Amen. Hymn number 508. We often sing this to a very fancy tune called Wolvercourt, but we'll sing it to the ordinary tune tonight, Andrew. Day of Rest, O Jesus, I have promised to serve thee to the end. 508.